First of all, I'm impressed that so many people would get up at this hour in the morning just to throw fruit. So this talk is a continuation or a development of a talk that I gave for one of the public outreach talks in February. These are talks that are organised once again by Damien and given for a general audience. Since we've got a slightly more technical audience here, I thought I'd put a little bit more detail into it, but not too much. And by way of a bit more introduction, I ripped this off Wikipedia. Pay particular attention to this bit here. So if any of you want to leave right now, I won't be offended. Okay. So this talk basically covers, well, I don't know how relevant it's going to be for physics teaching, but it's basically going to cover the four forces of nature in some way, shape, or form. I'm going to spend a bit of time for the first half of the talk basically discussing general relativity with a bit of a lead-in from special relativity and use that as motivation to discuss loop quantum gravity, which is one of the attempts to unify our understanding of quantum mechanics with our understanding of gravity as embodied in general relativity. I'm then going to move on and talk about the Standard Model, which since the 1970s or so has been our basic description of the other three forces of nature, that is electromagnetism, the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. And then finish up with some of the more speculative stuff, which is what I'm working on, which is the attempt to show that loop quantum gravity actually already contains the Standard Model, much to the surprise of an awful lot of people, myself included. And this section should possibly be called In Conclusions rather than Conclusions, but in any case. Can everybody hear me okay with the microphone? Is that working all right? That's good. Okay, so let's dive in. So, as motivation, by the end of the 19th century, physics had progressed pretty well in a classical sort of sense, but people were starting to discover a range of new phenomena that were making our old understandings of physics look a little bit shaky. There was the discovery of radioactivity, of course, and people were starting to realise that there was something a bit funny about light. Light was believed to be a wave. Waves require a medium to move in, and this medium was postulated to be something called the ether. But the ether had very strange properties. In order for light to propagate as fast as it does, the ether had to be incredibly stiff. It had to be a very, very rigid sort of medium that a wave was propagating at an incredibly high rate. And yet, it had to be sort of intangible enough that we could walk through it and hardly notice it. You know, planets could orbit around the sun without losing energy through friction through the ether and spiraling into the sun for a very long time. Nobody knew that the universe had been around for tens of billions of years at the time, but you know, it was obvious that the planets had to have very, very little frictional interaction with the ether. More to the point, the ether had never been observed. There was the famous Michelson-Morley experiment, which was designed to measure the different speed of the propagation of light in perpendicular directions as we moved through the ether, but there was no sign of it. James Clerk Maxwell's unification of electricity and magnetism had enabled him to derive the existence of electromagnetic waves, which just so happened to propagate at exactly the speed of light, which revealed the nature of light as an electromagnetic phenomenon. But the equations didn't incorporate any term that took account of the speed of the observer. So these equations were sort of subtly saying that no matter who the observer is, no matter how they're moving, they're always going to measure the same speed of light. So a lot of people look at things like this and go, well, that's pretty weird, I don't quite get it, what are we going to do? Einstein, and this is one of the, I think, the hallmarks of a really great physicist, just said, well, look, these are the facts, we have to take them at face value, right? And postulated that all inertial observers, that is, everybody who's not accelerating, will measure the same speed of light when they perform an experiment to measure light. So this has some pretty funny consequences when you stop and think about it. This is really the leaping off point for special relativity, but I like it because it doesn't involve any really full-on maths. You know, this is really high school level maths. So let's say that we have a device here, a light clock, for measuring time by bouncing a light signal from the bottom here up to the top, and just say it's a couple of mirrors, exactly one meter apart, and you measure how long it takes for the light to travel that 1 meter distance. Well, if you start to move this clock sideways in the direction of the purple arrow here, if everybody measures the same speed for light, then a light beam that starts off at the bottom of this clock as it's moving horizontally there is going to follow this diagonal track up here. So after one light, after one on C of a meter, the appropriate amount of time, rather than moving all the way up to the top of the clock here, it's only going to have moved up partway. And the faster this light clock is moving sideways, the more the light beam traveling up here is going to be leaned over. So each of these three green rays of light is the same length. The same amount of time has passed as measured by the stationary observer here. But as far as the observer who's moving sideways is concerned, when they try to say how much time has passed, they're going to say, oh look, only enough time has passed for my light beam to go halfway up my 1 meter distance. So the conclusion is, the faster you travel, the slower others observe you to be measuring the passage of time. Your little local clock that you're carrying along with you runs slower as measured by somebody else the faster you move. As far as you're concerned, nothing has changed. But as far as other observers are concerned, time is slowing down for you. And we can quantify this using good old Pythagoras' theorem. Here's a unit distance traveled by a light pulse in a time t naught. This side of our right angle triangle is just the fraction of the speed of light at which the little light clock thingy is moving sideways multiplied by t naught. And this length here corresponds with the time measured by the moving observer. Notice, of course, that this is all dimensionally consistent. Everything's in units of time. And then Pythagoras' theorem tells us that t naught squared is just equal to t squared plus this term here squared. Rearrange that, and we get the following equation, which tells us that the rate of time measured by on the moving observer's clock is given by the time on the stationary observer's clock multiplied by this little factor of the square root of 1 minus v squared on c squared. So this is one of the most famous factors in modern physics. Right. There you have one of the main results from special relativity, which drops out from basically one line of manipulation from Pythagoras' theorem. What about if we try to move our clock faster and faster and faster until it eventually goes faster than light? Go FTL, as people who read a lot of science fiction like to say. Well, clearly, this factor, 1 minus v squared on c squared, becomes imaginary when v is bigger than c. Now, that causes serious problems, right? What happens when you say that the rate of passage of time becomes imaginary? Well, fortunately, we never have to encounter that problem, because nothing can move faster than the speed of light. This is one of the edicts that comes out of Einstein's assumption that we all see light and moving at the same rate. Why not? Here's the nifty bit. Because nothing in the universe can move slower than the speed of light. You're nodding, I like that. Everything in the universe is moving at the speed of light. There is no other speed. How can this be? Some of you are probably saying, you're probably not, because you're nodding. Yeah. Some of you are probably saying, how can this be? You know, we're sitting here in this room, we're all sort of stationary, or a car drives down the road at 20 miles an hour or whatever, it's not moving at the speed of light. The answer is, of course, that we're moving through time as well as space. So, relativity requires that we extend our concept of motion and our concept of speed to take into account motion through a four-dimensional domain rather than just a three-dimensional one. So here's a diagram that should be familiar to anyone who's been in a physics class any time in the last 100 years. It's basically the standard sort of illustration. If you want to represent the motion of an object, you trace out a line on a space-time graph. The steeper the angle as it leans away from the time axis, the faster the object's going. We like to call these things world lines. And an important point to note, which is sometimes overlooked, is that an object's world line is also its time axis. The time axis for an object, for any observer, corresponds with all those coordinates that are zero, right? Something's moving along here, it's x coordinate or y coordinate or whatever, it is changing. But if something is sitting at the origin, its x coordinate just stays zero, and the time axis corresponds with the x equals zero coordinate. So.
But the world lines don't go through zero.
Oh, no, they don't necessarily. But I mean, that's just a rescaling of the coordinates, right? So. I could say that zero x coordinate for me is positioned over here, and you, if you were creating your own set of coordinates, would say that the zero x coordinate is positioned over there. But we can still do a transformation between those two coordinates. Right. As far as this observer is concerned, this blue line here, that line up there corresponds with x equals zero at any time. So these lines here, these world lines, are really the time axes for each observer. So this diagram I love because it just gives you the whole of special relativity in one easy diagram. Let's say we take some observer and accelerate it up to some reasonable fraction of the speed of light, possibly by resorting to Bovine intervention. I warn you. as our cow starts travelling faster and faster and faster, its time axis tips over, and it trades off some of its extension in space and some of its extension in time, so that the rate of passage of time that you see. That a stationary observer who's living on these axes here would measure is just the projection down onto their time axis of the time measured by the cow. Right? So here we have, let's say, t equals zero, and here we have t equals 1 second as measured by the cow. Well, that projects down to less than 1 second for the stationary observer here. And the ratio by the fraction by which it shrinks is just, you can just read off using Pythagoras' theorem like we did before, or by grabbing a ruler and holding it up here and measuring how much time has passed. Notice also that the length of the cow shrinks, okay? So the distance from its back feet to its front feet has been shrunk by the same corresponding amount. And there's another cute feature in here as well, which is also shown by this diagram, which is one of the reasons I like this diagram. The front of the cow is at an earlier time than the back of the cow. As far as the cow is concerned, the time is, you know, the time is 3 o'clock at my nose and at my tail. But as far as the stationary observer is concerned, the time at the front of the cow is earlier than the time at the back of the cow. So there's a desynchronization that takes place as well. And you can read all of this off without any need for any sort of mathematical trickery, just by looking at a diagram like this. All right, so that's special relativity in one easy diagram. So much for objects with constant velocity. We all know that life gets more interesting when you talk about acceleration. So how do you judge acceleration? Well, on a fixed surface, you can detect gravity, a classic form of acceleration, by dropping an object. In free fall, over here, there's no apparent gravity. So we all know that if you're in an elevator or something that's dropping at 9.81 meters per second squared, and you let go of an object, it'll fall at the same rate, accelerate at the same rate, and you won't be able to observe that there's any gravity there. Conversely, if you're in a rocket that's accelerating upwards in free space but far away from any sources of gravity, like any planets or stars, it looks like there's gravity. It looks like you might be standing on the surface of a planet. So how can you tell the difference? How do you know whether or not you're in a rocket that's being accelerated by the engines firing, or stationary standing on the surface of a planet? Well, the trick is, locally, you can't tell the difference. But if you make a comparison between two different points that are spatially separated, then you can tell. So if you're standing in a rocket and you drop two separate objects like so, they'll fall parallel with each other. But if you're standing on the surface of the Earth and you drop two objects that are spatially separated, they're both going to head towards the center of the Earth. The center of the Earth is at slightly different angles for both of them, so they'll actually start to converge as they fall. The moral of the story is that gravity is distinct from acceleration due to motion because it shrinks space together. Okay. So here's a piece of flat space represented with a coordinate system on it. If you trace a straight path across that, it's just a straight path. Now let's take a part of the flat space here and pull out some of it, like cut out a wedge of it and squeeze it back together, shrink it up, like so. So now instead of having eight of these radial lines here in this bit in the middle, we've only got six. We've squeezed everything together to fit. Now, if we trace out our straight path across there, it's going to get distorted by the distortion of space-time. Okay, or the distortion of just space in this case, right? So, as far as this region of space is concerned, we've just got a straight line drawn across it. Every point, if you traced out the coordinates as measured on this little grid here, is still the same as the ones that had the line going through them before, but now the space is distorted, and so the straight path that was going through it, as far as some external observer is concerned, has been bent. There's another feature that we want to deal with acceleration, and that is the effect on the light beam. So if you have a light beam that's shining across a rocket from side to side, and the rocket is accelerating, in the time that it takes the light beam to travel across the rocket will pick up a bit of speed, so the light beam will seem to bend down towards the floor. If the acceleration due to the rocket engine's firing is the same as the acceleration due to standing on the surface of a planet and having a gravitational field, then you would expect that if I took a flashlight or a torch and shone the light beam, or grab my laser pointer and shine it across the room, that light beam is going to bend downwards ever so slightly, but still bend downwards due to the effect of gravity.
But if it goes at constant speed, wouldn't it show the same?
Just coming to that. So this is the point that you're getting at. Light always travels at the speed of light, which is a constant. But if the light beam bends, then the section of the light beam moving across the top of the beam seems to be going a greater distance than the part that's gone across the bottom, because we've got two arcs. So this appears to be a contradiction with the idea that light travels at a constant speed. The way Einstein got out of this is really clever. What he realized is that there's no contradiction. Time runs more slowly at the bottom of the beam. Time is actually running slower, just like it was when we had a moving observer. Okay. So there's a distortion of time, which means that as far as some local observer at the bottom of the beam is concerned, light is still moving at light speed. So this actually comes back to an idea that Galileo came up with. And remember what I said about how we're all moving through time as well as through space. When Galileo first started doing his experiments, rolling balls down inclined slopes and all that sort of jazz, he had to come up with some explanation for why objects fell. So it's a bit of a fallacy that Newton was the first person to pick up gravity. It's actually heaps of people were thinking about gravity before Newton came along. Kepler was thinking about it, Galileo was thinking about it, all sorts of people were thinking about it. Galileo had to figure out why objects should fall and why they should fall at the speed that they do. One possibility he considered was that there was a wind that was constantly blowing into the Earth that sucked everything down. He realized, you know, there's no such thing as gravity, the Earth sucks. And he realized that if this was the case, then all objects, irrespective of what they were made of or what their mass was, they would eventually reach the same terminal velocity, the same speed that the wind was blowing. But that obviously wasn't the case. Then he thought, maybe the speed at which an object falls is determined by the distance that it has already travelled through. Okay. But after a little bit of thought, not very much thought in fact, you realise that that can't work, because if an object starts off stationary, it hasn't moved through any distance, so it won't ever pick up any speed. It won't move at all. You'd release an object and it just wouldn't fall. Even worse, if you threw it up, it'd be starting to move upwards, so it would have moved through an upward distance. And velocity and distance being vector quantities, once you threw something up, it would start to fall upwards and keep falling faster and faster in an upward direction, which obviously doesn't happen. Then eventually he thought, well, maybe it's related to the time that the objects were spent falling. And here he was spot on. As we all know, the velocity of an object is proportional to its acceleration multiplied by the time over which that acceleration acts. So gravity, which was realized a long time before Einstein, is related to the motion through time. And here's another nice little diagram. Now we get general relativity in one easy diagram. We can represent the fact that time runs slower, closer to a gravitating object, like the surface of a planet, by distorting the time axes on our little space-time diagram. So here there's less gravity and time runs a bit faster. Here there's more gravity and the time axis is longer, so you have to move further through space and time to get to the corresponding later times. You know, here's 1 second, here's 2 seconds, here's 3 seconds, but to get to 3 seconds over on this side, you have to go all the way up to here. So you trace out a straight line path for an object falling across time and space, and then if you bend that diagram back so that everything looks straight, hey presto, you've got a curved path. Exactly what you see in reality. If you throw an object and watch it fall follows this nice little parabolic path. Notice also that, as well as bending time, I've also distorted space here, so that the little kicks along the bottom, which you might not be able to see properly, are spaced differently to correspond with the fact that space gets squeezed up by gravity. Here I've spaced them out evenly. So that's general relativity in one straightforward diagram. So relativity in a nutshell. Everything moves through space-time at the speed of light. We might as well just call it the speed. Space-time paths are straight lines. Every object likes to follow a straight path through space and time. If the space and time is distorted, then the object will follow a straight path through that distorted time. Right? It'll just follow along one foot in front of the other. Exactly as if you were driving down a bent road, right? The road might curve and wind, but you just keep going straight down the road. As far as you're concerned, you're going straight ahead. But somebody else watching from elsewhere will see you curving all over the place. Of course, if you have collisions, then the direction of objects moving changes, but that's a side issue. Gravity is a modification of space-time distances and angles. So the standard rubber sheet image that people show when they try to represent what space, what general relativity is all about is actually pretty misleading, because it gives this impression that somehow space curves down and there's sort of uber gravity that exists outside that pulls everything down on the rubber sheet. I greatly prefer to have this illustration of just the grid lines drawn on the surface being changed around, so we'll have none of that. Both time and space are distorted. Okay, gravity is a double effect. It's due to the distortion of space and the distortion of time. Now, when Einstein proposed general relativity, one of the predictions he made was for how the orbit of Mercury was changed, how the perihelion processed around the Sun. And it turned out that he predicted, because of this space and time contribution, he predicted an effect which was twice as large as what you would expect from just Newtonian gravity, which turned out to be spot on. And locally, space-time seems flat. If you look at a sufficiently small region of space-time, we would expect that the curvature just gets smoothed out in exactly the same way that if you take a circle and look at it and zoom in close enough, it starts to look like a straight line. So in that case, special relativity rules. Now, I made an allusion there to comparing distances and angles. The way that we do that is by using what's called a metric. I'm not sure how many of you guys deal with this, but metrics are usually present implicitly in any calculation involving vectors. But usually the metric is just one in flat Euclidean space. So the metric's a function that tells us how the points in space and time are related to each other. They tell us what connects with what angles form between different points. Like I said, it's an extra factor which is usually neglected. So usually when you say take two vectors, A and B, and take the dot product of them, we say, right, we'll sum over the components, say there's three components, if we're talking about three-dimensional space, sum from I equals 1 to 3 of AI times BI. But what we should really be doing is summing over I equals 1 to 3 and J equals 1 to 3 of G sub IJ times AI and BJ, where this GIJ factor here, this metric, tells us the cosines of the angles between the different directions that we're talking about. Right? So I and J are standing in here for X, Y, and Z. That's sort of the more precise statement. And this is what you have to do when you're dealing with space that's not flat, that's not Euclidean, if it's distorted by the presence of gravitational field or whatever. So a metric in flat Euclidean space, the metric is just the unit matrix, right? You know, the cosine of the angle between the x direction and the x direction is 1. Cosine of the angle between the x direction and the y direction or the z direction is 0. So all of the terms that lie down the axis are 1. All the other terms are 0. One's your uncle. In flat space-time, special relativity, we deal with four dimensions rather than three. One of those dimensions is time. And it turns out that we have what's called the Minkowski metric. Incidentally, for four dimensions, usually for three dimensions, we use I and J to represent the directions, the indices. In four dimensions, we tend to use Greek letters, so mu, and so on. So in special relativity, the metric is this what's called the Minkowski metric, where you have 1, 1, 1 for the spatial directions and minus 1 for the time direction. And far from sources of gravity, if you're talking about general relativity, but with gravity taken away, or at very short distance scales, you would have the full metric, which in general might have terms that aren't zero living off here on the off diagonal parts, just reducing down to this Minkowski metric. But in full general relativity, you've got distortions in space-time, we've got planets and stars and things that create distortions where the coordinate axes get twisted around so they're not necessarily perpendicular to each other, then in general, this G mu nu metric is going to tell you how space is distorted by giving you information in all of these off-diagonal terms about what angle corresponds with what distance corresponds with what. Okay. So, sure. While I'm taking a swig of water, that's a really good opportunity.
That's not very good with math and matrices. Why was it minus 1 for time? Why is it minus?
That's actually not a silly question. The point is that if you have, if we have our requirement that the speed of light is always constant, and then if you measure a distance through space and time, and apply your Pythagoras' theorem rule, then you pick up a minus sign when you pull. You say the total distance is equal to, C multiplied by T, right? Yeah. then when you pull apart the x and y components, you wind up with the x and y components on opposite sides, so there's a relative minus sign between them. Sorry, that's sort of the brief, rough and ready answer. Run through in a bit more detail if you'd like. But, so, where was I? Okay. So, there's two important principles that general relativity teaches us. Right? Because it tells us that space and time are dynamic. They're not just some static, fixed background that everything takes place on, like Newton thought they were. They're not just some fixed stage. They're actually part of the game. So these two principles have the imposing names of general covariance and diffeomorphism invariance. General covariance just tells us that the laws of physics should have the same form no matter how you choose your coordinates, right? Diffeomorphism invariance tells us that it doesn't matter how the space-time should be twisted and distorted and stretched around, we should still measure the same connections between the same points. Right? It's a bit like a way of saying that the foot bone's connected to the leg bone's connected to the hip bone's connected to the back bone, and it doesn't matter, I can do whatever I like, but still, all those bones are still connected to each other. So ultimately, the coordinates that we choose are meaningless. We could choose any other set of coordinates and we should still get exactly the same answers. So we want a theory that is what we might call background independent. In other words, in contradiction to what I just told you, we want a theory where the metric is not just equal to this fixed flat background, this Minkowski metric, plus some small additional corrections. So this term over on the right here really represents a flat, fixed, static background plus a little bit of extra stuff added on top, some perturbations. But we don't want that. We want a theory that tells us that space-time is completely dynamic. It can take any old shape we like. It can be as lumpy as anything. Now, that brings us to a question. If space and time are dynamic, how do we study the dynamics of space and time? What's the best way to study the motion or the dynamics of some physical system? It doesn't matter what physical system we're talking about. Rolling billiard balls, swinging pendulum, clothes in a washing machine, ripples on a pond. What's the best way to study it? Any ideas? Find a conserved quantity, right? As physicists, we like to make life easy for ourselves. You don't want to try to study how clothes are moving around in a washing machine by following the motion of every single piece of clothing. You would rather say, well, if I put two t-shirts and five pairs of undies in there, then when I open it up at the end, I'm going to pull out two t-shirts and five pairs of undies. Obviously, that doesn't work with socks, but there's an exception to everything.
No, it works for the washer. It doesn't work for the dryer.
Mm-hmm. I'll put that in the next version of the talk. Okay, so using conserved quantities makes life a whole lot easier for us, right? And one of the classic conserved quantities is total energy, kinetic energy plus potential energy. The use of this quantity was really brought to a very high level by Hamilton. And so, in honor of him, we tend to refer to this quantity as the Hamiltonian. And he found a way of studying the dynamics of a system using what are called generalized coordinates and generalized momenta. So generalized means that they don't necessarily have to be physical positions in space and the corresponding momentum. They could be anything. If you're talking about a pendulum, you could choose the angle that it's hanging from the vertical as your generalized coordinate and then choose the appropriate corresponding momentum. And the equations of motion of a system, once you choose a good set of generalized coordinates, could be found by using just these two equations here. Take the Hamiltonian, differentiate it with respect to momentum, and you get the time derivative of the position. Likewise, take the negative of the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to position, and you get the time derivative of the momentum. And that approach works for everything, from atoms to stars. So here's an example. Say we have a classic problem of a mass on a spring. We'll pick the generalized coordinate to be just the extension of the spring. and we've got a mass of m sitting on the end of a spring. So the kinetic energy is just p squared on 2m. The potential energy is given by the half kx squared term. Take the derivative of that Hamiltonian with respect to p, and we get dx dt. Take minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to x, and we get dp dt, which is equal to minus kx. Put that together, and we're copying that down. We'll leave that up a bit longer. And hey presto, we get an equation which tells us that mass times acceleration equals minus kx. Just a restatement of F equals ma, but it's a really nifty way of getting it. And it, like I said, it's a very generalized way of finding the equations of motion for pretty much any old system. And you can do this for general relativity. You can treat the metric, which tells you how space-time is distorted and shaped, treat it as if it's a field, and form a Hamiltonian, which tells you how the field moves. So in 1986, Abhay Ashtekar rewrote this GR Hamiltonian in terms of the following. As coordinates, he chose what are called connections, which are functions that transport you along paths through space. And momenta were a corresponding quantity, which people tend to refer to as an electric field. It's a slightly confusing choice of terminology. It's not quite like an electric field, but you can think of it as being kind of like if you have a path which corresponds to an electric current, then you have a field which curls around it, and it follows the same basic rules as an electric field, so people call it an electric field. The connections create networks in space. So you have a region of space, plot out all the different connections between the points, and you get this huge, very complicated mess. Something like this. As time goes by, you develop from one three-dimensional region of space to another later three-dimensional region of space with a different set of networks in it. Now, here's where the trick comes in. This is really cool. Because of diffeomorphism invariance, you would think that there's an infinite number of ways that you can create these networks, right? But because of diffeomorphism invariance, a whole huge class of these things collapse down to being the same network. Now, these two guys are just the same thing, distorted around, you know, hip bones still connected to the backbone still connected to the neck bone, and so on. So rather than having an infinite class of possible networks embedded into the sort of three-dimensional space, you just have a very restricted class of these things. Anything else I want to say? Okay. All right. And it turns out, because of this, rather than saying, let's think of space as a whole region in its own right, you can just represent space by the networks themselves. So, a little diagram here, if I can control. So you can create a kind of framework for space built out of networks embedded in the space. And the way the networks connect up to each other tells you something about how the different points within space connect up to each other. So now I can pull this pre-existing space away. I'm left with the network, which still tells me what the space I started off was like. And I can associate with each node where these lines meet up, I can associate a little bubble of space. And so on. In much the same way that in chemistry, you have sort of space-filling models of molecules and ball and stick models of molecules. So these networks are kind of like the ball and stick version of space. And the space itself, made up of little bubbly regions of space, is like the space-filling models of molecules.
Are masses at those nodes?
Sorry?
Masses at those nodes?
No, locations are at, actually volumes are at these nodes. So it turns out that, remember I said that there was a sort of conjugate electric field thing associated with each one of these lines. It turns out that each that the field, in the same way that you can think of a field cutting through an area and giving you a total flux through an area, you can work backwards, take the field associated with each one of these lines and associate an area with it. Okay. I won't go into the maths because it's kind of tedious and time-consuming here. Not very illuminating. But in sort of rough, hand-wavy fashion, if you have a field and there are a certain number of field lines associated with it, you can trace back and say, let's treat the number of field lines as if it corresponds directly with an area. So each one of these lines, each in the network, picks up some units of area. And when you have several areas coming together, you can associate a volume with that. So if you wanted to calculate the volume rather than, one way of calculating volume, just quickly, one way of calculating volume is to say length by width by height. The other way of doing it is to say area by area by area, take the square root, so you've got a volume.
So where are these nodes exist and you've got these volumes, is that a location in space in which something might locate, and when they move through space, are they moving along, is something moving along lines or moving from one volume?
Right. They are, so you're pretty much spot on. Each one of these nodes here corresponds with a volume which is a location in space. A bit like pixels on a TV screen, right, or a computer screen. That it's a location in space that has a certain volume associated with it where something can be. The paths here are connections between regions of space. So it's like space has a bubbly structure, like a whole series of soap bubbles. And the paths tell you which points, or which bubbles of space are connected to which. So how you can get from one point to another is determined by which paths exist in the intermediate regions. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Sorry, just a sec. Woman behind you, the person behind you had a question. Yeah.
Is that why all the nodes have three lines going against them?
Yes. Well, I mean, if there were only two lines, they wouldn't be a node. It would just be another line. But
you can have more, or?
You can have more, yes. Yeah, you can have three or four or something. In fact, the diagram I've done there is slightly misleading. Because, in fact, there's also an argument which says that if you have only three lines coming together, three lines doesn't necessarily uniquely give you a volume. All it really does, you can always lay three lines out, or three vectors out in a plane, right? If you have three vectors and you join them up like so, it gives you a triangle, which is a planar object which has no volume. So in general, you would actually need more. You would actually need to have, say, four lines to give you like a little tetrahedron in order to ensure that you actually have something that has volume. So the diagram there is a little bit deceptive because I've only got three lines coming into each node. But for the sake of illustration, for pedagogical reasons, it works. You and next to you, sorry.
I had the same question.
Okay.
What's the significance of the lines that will join up in your diagram?
Okay. It's called the edge of the page.
How about this one here?
Okay. Now, to be slightly less flippant about it, the idea of lines that don't join up with anything, they represent boundaries, horizons. So, for example, if you have the event horizon of a black hole, there's a line going into it. The line doesn't connect up with anything, it just sort of disappears into the black hole. And the number of lines going in tells you the surface area of the event horizon of the black hole, or the horizon or the edge of the universe or whatever it happens to be. There's some, one of the interesting results that's come out of quantum gravity in recent years is that there seems to be a good calculation based on this idea, which associates event horizon area with the entropy of a black hole, and that reproduces the results that Stephen Hawking came out with back in the 70s. So that kind of, skips straight over everything I was going to say about this slide. So, yeah, we developed this nice image of space-time as being represented by what we call a dual network. So the network's dual to the actual volumes of space itself, the lines correspond with areas, and the nodes themselves correspond with volumes of space. And because, now here's because this is a network, and there are only a finite number of them rather than an infinite range corresponding with every possible little distortion that you can imagine, these regions of space are automatically quantized. It's automatic. Rather than having just a continuous smooth space that's spread out everywhere like some sort of fluid, space is actually developed this granular bubbly structure corresponding with the nodes. So it's quantized just like energy and matter. So here's the story so far. At the smallest scale, space-time is bubbly. It's got a quantum structure made of discrete bits. It has discrete area and volume. The largest scale structure of space-time is just lots and lots of bubbles all stuck together, and the networks just represent the connections between the bubbles. So let's take a swig of water, take a deep breath.
Do the nodes have the same volume?
Depends how many lines are going into this, and the sort of electric flux associated with the lines coming in. But they're all in units of what's called the Planck volume. So let's take a deep breath and dive into the next bit, the other three forces besides gravity. So here's some stuff represented by a passion fruit. Yum. As we delve deeper and deeper into the layers of this, we find passion fruits are made out of molecules. Molecules are made out of atoms. Atoms are made out of electrons, protons, neutrons, all clustered together in the nucleus there with the electrons going around the outside. And the protons and neutrons are made of smaller particles called quarks. Protons and neutrons are each made of three quarks, which have a quantity called color, which is not actually the color that we see in the real world, of course. And surprisingly, when you get down to this level, absolutely everything in the universe can be described using just these three particles here with the neutrino stuff on for a bit of fun. So here's the whole universe, right? There are two types of particles, two types of quarks, called the up quark and the down quark. Then there's electrons, and then there's a neutral particle, kind of like an electron with no charge and hardly any mass, called the neutrino, which we all know, right? Up quarks have a charge of plus 2/3, down quarks have a charge of minus 1/3, electrons have a charge of minus 1. And there are two extra generations of corresponding particles called the charm, strange, muon-type neutrino, the top, the bottom, the tau, and the tau-type neutrino, which reproduce the same electric charges. But ordinary matter, the stuff that we're made of, is all formed from the stuff on the top row here, the first generation. All of this other stuff is just exotic stuff that occurs very briefly in powerful nuclear reactions, either in stars or in particle accelerators. And these particles are all regarded as being fundamental. You know, we don't split the quark and find something smaller. So the quarks, as I mentioned, have a property called colour, which is not the colour that we see in the real world. It's related to how they bind together. Excuse me. All of these particles, which are called fermions, all of them have electric charge with the exception of the neutrinos here. all of them have mass. It was thought up until very recently that neutrinos have no mass. And then just in the late 90s, it was discovered conclusively that neutrinos, at least two out of the three neutrinos, do have mass. And the quarks, as I mentioned, have color charge. So all the interactions in the universe are described by four forces associated with these charges. There's the color interaction, also called the strong nuclear force. There's the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactive decay. There's electromagnetism. And as we just discussed at great length, there's also gravity. Electromagnetism, color, and the weak force are all mediated by what are called bosons. Now, physicists like to draw out these diagrams of fermions as straight lines with arrows on them and bosons as wiggly lines. Bosons are like little messenger particles that tell the fermions, hey, there's another fermion over here that's carrying this much charge, this much mass, whatever. People sometimes represent this as if you have fermions throwing baseball backwards and forwards or whatever and conveying force like this, but I prefer to think of it as carrying information. The colour interaction, which is described by a theory called quantum chromodynamics, works pretty much like electromagnetism. You know, in the electric interaction, you have positive and negative charges, and the positives and negatives attract. But the colour interaction, you have three different types of charge. Positive and negative, it's red, green, and blue. And rather than having positive and negative attract, all three, red, green, and blue, like to come together to form a colour-neutral combination. So that's why the name colour was chosen, because you get red, green, and blue, and they come together to make white. So all the particles, all the protons and neutrons that we see are all formed from, say, a red plus a green plus a blue quark stuck together. Or you can have some other exotic particles which are formed from a red particle and an anti-red antiparticle. But either way, you've got zero total colour, but the overall result is colourless. And these are held together by the exchange of particles called gluons. So the gluons carry colour and anti-colour backwards and forwards between the quarks. So here we've got a diagram of a blue up quark coming in. It spits out a gluon, which carries away some of the blueness and also carries away some anti-redness. So by losing blueness and losing anti-redness, it changes from being a blue up quark into a red up quark. And then that gluon interacts with another up quark here, which starts off red and winds up coming away in blue. And there are similar interactions for greens and blues and reds and greens, all interacting with each other and so on. The weak interaction follows the same basic pattern, except that instead of having gluons that carry a colour and an anti-colour, you can figure out there's going to be a range of different gluons, right? You've got six different possible permutations of red, green, red, blue, whatever. Plus, incidentally, there's two others that don't change colour, but that's a side issue. So eight gluons in total. There are actually three different type of bosons for the weak interaction, called the W plus, the W minus, and the Z naught. So the weak interaction allows the quarks and leptons to change across generations. I'll just run back to this diagram. Actually, this diagram is a bit easier to see. So rather than having things that bounce off each other, a W plus carries away one full unit of positive electric charge, say. So if an up quark spits out one full unit of positive electric charge, it goes from having a charge of plus 2/3 to a charge of minus 1/3, and that turns it into a down quark. Likewise, if a neutrino were to spit out one full unit of positive electric charge, its charge goes down to minus 1 and it turns into an electron. So there's this sideways interaction in these little pairs all the way across this table that's mediated by the weak interaction. And that's actually what's at the heart of radioactive decay. You know, when an up quark turns into a down quark, the corresponding proton that it's sitting in will turn into a neutron. So here's an example here. An up quark turns into a down quark. The W plus particle gets spat out. And then that W plus can then go off and decay into a neutrino and a positron. There's another interesting weak interaction here. This involves one of these second generation particles, the muon. So a muon can come along, turn into a muon type neutrino, spit out a W minus, and that W minus can then decay and split into an electron and an anti-neutrino. Now, the fact that the neutrino that comes out here and the anti-neutrino that come out here are different types of neutrino was the first hint that there are actually several different generations of fermions. So this is actually a diagram that corresponds to an experimental result from back in the 1940s or 50s or so. Now, all of these particles have a property called spin, which you can think of in slightly deceptive mental image, but you can think of the particle as being like a little spinning top. And we call them left-handed or right-handed in the standard manner. You just apply the right-hand rule. Thumb goes that way, fingers curl around that way, and it's a right-handed particle. It goes the opposite way, it's a left-handed particle. You can create left-handed particles, but from right-handed particles by reflecting them in a mirror, clearly. All fermion, all of this spin is quantized in units of h bar, Planck's constant, and all fermions have a half a unit of spin, and if the spin is aligned in the direction that the particle is traveling, it's spin up. If it's aligned in the opposite direction, it's spin down. All bosons have integer spin rather than half integer spin. So 0, 1, 2, whatever. Now, one of the big surprises that came out from the study of spin was in the 1950s, it was expected that the whole world was mirror symmetric. Right? It was expected that, you know, if you take a billiard table and you film somebody playing billiards, right, and then you show the film to somebody threaded into the projector reversed, so it comes out as a mirror image, no one will be able to tell the difference, right? Because all of the force vectors, all of the collisions will all work out just fine, whether you're going left or right or right or left. If you take a coffee cup, right, and drop it on the floor, that's a gravitational interaction. Look at that happening in reality, or look at it happening in a mirror, it still looks basically the same. You know, presuming that there's nothing written on the coffee cup, right, that gives away the fact that it's being reflected in a mirror. But, you know, your gravitational interaction looks exactly the same when you look at it directly, when you look at it in a mirror. Likewise, electromagnetic interactions all work out the same. So it was expected that the whole universe was left-right mirror symmetric. And then in 1959, C.S. Wu performed this experiment where she and her team got a group of cobalt-60 nuclei lined up in a magnetic field, and as they decayed, watched how the electrons that got spat out came off. And it turned out that all the electrons came out in one direction. Doesn't sound so surprising, but imagine what would happen if you reflected that in a mirror. The particle, the nucleus, seems to be spinning the opposite direction. So the spin axis, or the spin vector, for the nucleus is suddenly reversed. But now, the electrons aren't coming out parallel with the spin axis, they're coming out anti-parallel. This is really weird when you stop and think about it, right? Here's an interaction that unambiguously enables you to tell whether or not you're looking at it directly or looking at it in a mirror. This was really shocking when it was first discovered. And it turns out that this is the hallmark of the weak force. The weak interaction is actually completely asymmetric. And the underlying reason is that all neutrinos are left-handed. So there's no such thing as a right-handed neutrino. Why? Okay, the cry goes up, why on earth should this be the case? Well, one possible answer is provided by what are called prions. What's a prion? Well, they're not these. You remember I said earlier that yeah, I have a fondness for cows. Gary Larson cartoon was all infected me as a child. So remember I said earlier that it was believed that electrons, neutrons, quarks were all supposed to be fundamental. Well, in the 1970s it was proposed that they weren't fundamental after all, but they were actually subcomponents. And the most famous sort of proposal for this were what are called Richelmans. Now these were actually proposed independently by two separate researchers, Harari and Hsu, who proposed basically exactly the same idea at exactly the same time, got their two respective papers independently written up and published on subsequent pages of the same journal. That's how close it was in one of these cases of an idea whose time has come. Unfortunately for poor old Shoot, because his article came second, nobody remembers him. Everyone refers to these things as the Richelieu model, and he talks about Harari's model. So sometimes science can be unfair. So I'm going to stick with the standard practice and snub poor old Mr. Shoot. But in short, the idea was that there are two types of subquark particles called T and V, plus corresponding antiparticles, T bar and V bar. The T's were supposed to carry a charge equal to one-third the charge on an electron, or one-third the charge on a proton, actually. The T-bars carried the opposite charge, one-third the charge on an electron. The V's and the V-bars had no electric charge. Now, if you assume that you could stick these things together into triplets with no mixing of the anti-Richelieu's and Richelieu's, then you come up with various possible combinations that you can make, like three T-bars gives you the same electric charge as an electron. Three T's gives you the same charge as a positron. Three V bars or three V's give you the same charge as an antineutrino or a neutrino. And then, hey presto, there's three different ways that you can combine two of one type and one of another. These guys all have fractional electric charges because they've got either one neutral particle and one two charged particles, or two neutral particles and one charged particle. But there's three different permutations of the way you can put these things together. So people looked at this and went, hey, maybe these three different permutations correspond with colour charge. Maybe this is what colour is all about. And that was pretty cool. So this is a really nice idea. It explains the number and type of fermions. It explains why the standard model has those particles. It explains why the coloured particles, the quarks, have fractional electric charge. There's a really neat feature about it, which is that in any neutral lump of matter, be it a hydrogen atom or a table or whatever, if you count up all of the T bars and T's and V bars and V's that go into that, you get exactly the same number. Right. There's no asymmetry between the amount of matter and antimatter present if you look at it in terms of Richelieu's and anti-Richelieu's. So one of the big mysteries about the universe and the way it is why are we all made of matter? Why aren't there galaxies of antimatter out there corresponding with all the galaxies of matter? The answer might be that, in fact, the matter and antimatter are hiding in combination at this sort of Richelieu level. And proposing that these particles were composite is sort of the least radical idea of explaining why there should be fermions and bosons of the standard model, and why that should exist. People come up with all sorts of other things, you know, extra dimensions and superstrings and all sorts like this, but compositeness is kind of the least radical idea because it's worked in the past. Passion fruit are composite, they're made out of molecules. Molecules are composite, they're made out of atoms, and so on. On the con side, philosophically, labelling Richelieu's as first, second, and third in a permutation is just as arbitrary as assigning some sort of colour to them, and there's absolutely no experimental evidence of substructure. So now we're getting finally into what I actually work on and my stuff. So this is the large grain of salt part of the talk. I said to myself one day, let's construct the Richelieu model from a different starting point. Rather than thinking of these things as being little particles, like smaller versions of electrons or protons or whatever, let's treat them as some sort of a topological structure. What's the simplest topological structure you can imagine? Well, take two lines and cross them over each other. That gives you something that looks like a ribbon that's been twisted through 180 degrees, either left-handed or right-handed. Join those together into pairs, and you get three possible combinations. You can either take a twist and a counter-twist, and just get back to having a flat ribbon, or you take two twists in the same direction, and you get a full twist one way, or do it the other way, you get a full twist the other way. Well, that's kind of like the T's and V's of the Richelieu model. We have, you know, a full twist one way could be like a T, full twist the other way could be like an anti-T, and the untwisted flat ribbon could be like the V's and V-bars, but wrapped up together into the same object. I like to call these things helons because they're helical, and I identify the twist here with electric charge. Now, just like in the Richelieu idea, let's combine these guys into a triplet. Well, if you just put three things side by side like that, you can't tell which one comes where in the triplet. There's no automatic ordering. But because these things aren't just particles stuck together, you can actually do something more interesting with them. You could allow them to, in general, wrap around each other. So let them braid around like this. And then all of a sudden, you lose that rotational invariance. All of a sudden, you can tell the three strands apart. If you look at it from any angle, you can look at it and say, oh, look, this strand crosses over that strand and under that strand. It must be the same strand I was looking at earlier from a different angle. So if the ordering of these objects within a triplet matters, if it gives you different permutations, here we have a reason why that should be the case, rather than having to arbitrarily say, this is the first strand, this is the second strand, this is the third strand. They sort of select themselves by the way they wrap around each other. And then we can go through and reproduce all the results from the Richelieu model by putting them together into triplets. So if we have three of these H plus helons, we get a positron. If we have three H minus helons, we get an electron. Remember that the pluses and minuses just correspond with whether the thing's twisting left-handed or right-handed. And then we get all of the corresponding quarks and antiquarks in three different permutations. But we've got a gap here. We don't get an antineutrino. So in short, we have just twists that come together into pairs that correspond to electric charges, triplets, and no mixing of H pluses and H minuses. So basically the same idea that we had for the Richelieu model, but using these funny sort of extended ribbon objects rather than particles. Now, funny things happen when you start to join braids together. So if you take a braid and the corresponding top to bottom mirror image of a braid, join the ends up, hey presto, what you get is a braid that can then be deformed back into a trivial structure like this. So that looks a little bit like taking a particle and its antiparticle and annihilating them together. So we can do this with all the possible combinations of a braid with no charges, a braid with one charge, a braid with two charges, a braid with three charges, and so on. Mirrored sort of left and right, so maybe these are like right-handed particles and these are like left-handed particles going that way or that way. Mirror them top to bottom, and we get all the corresponding antiparticles. I'm starting to rush through a bit here, but it's sort of running short on time. But stop me and ask questions if you want. So we can sort of use these braids with twists on them to construct all of the particles of the standard model. And when we join them up top to bottom, like join, say, an anti-up quark with an up quark, hey presto, it'll come together and give a trivial result. So all the fermions are essentially just neutrinos with some twist added. It's like everything in the world is neutrinos with electric charge painted onto it somehow. The left and right mirroring of gray, like so, changing that say to that, corresponds with left-handed or right-handed particles. The top-to-bottom mirroring is equivalent to what we call C inversion, or swapping particles for antiparticles. Now, here's the neat bit. For each non-zero value of the electric charge, there's four combinations of charge and handedness. Right? So you can have a positive or negative left-handed particle, or a positive or negative right-handed particle. But if the charge equals zero, then there's only two possible combinations. So there's half as many neutral particles as there are charged particles, which is exactly what we see in the real world. Right? Left-handed and right-handed electrons, left-handed and right-handed quarks, but only left-handed neutrinos, right? And only right-handed antineutrinos. Then, if you make more complicated braids with more crossings in them, you can have something that looks like several different generations of particles. So remember that the charge on a particle in this idea is represented by the number of twists sitting on the strands. You can add more crossings to the braid without changing the number of twists, and you have a reproduction of the electric charges from the first generation, but with more complicated braiding structures. Link up braids top to bottom, the twists can spread up and down, and that allows you to exchange charges, turning, say, an up quark here into a down quark over here, just like a weak interaction. Right? So we take an up quark here, join it up with an electron, let the twists spread up through the middle here, so this bit where the twists are spreading backwards and forwards is kind of like a W boson. Split it apart again, and hey presto, we've got something that I showed you earlier in one of those diagrams, just drawn in a different way. Here's that muon decaying into a muon neutrino process that I showed you before. Start off with something that's got, say, three crossings on it, split off a little bit here, which is like our W minus particle. We're left with something that has no charge on it, so it's a neutrino. Then let this split apart into two more particles, and that's like an electron and an antineutrino. And notice the really nice touch here. Because the number of crossings doesn't change when we split the twists off the bottom, this must be, if this starts off as a second generation particle, it must remain a second generation particle. So we can't have this particle turning from a muon into a tau-type neutrino or an electron-type neutrino. It has to turn into a muon-type neutrino. It has to stay in the second generation, which is exactly what we observe in the real world.
How have we made the third split on that one?
The third split here?
No, the previous one. No, the same diagram.
Same diagram.
Yeah. The second vertex from the right, yeah.
This one.
Yeah. What did you do with
this one here?
And going from second to the third.
Right, okay. So what we've done here, the bit here stays the same, and nothing happens all the way across here.
Yeah.
At this stage, we've got a trivial braid, right? So we've got three parallel strands. And actually, I'll move it a little bit here. So I've got three parallel strands, like so. Now, I'll take one of those strands and pull it over the top of the others. So it goes like that, okay? And then do the corresponding sort of thing with the other strand, so that I wind up with something up here. But when I draw a line through the middle, what I get is the stuff on the bottom is the mirror image of the stuff on the top. So what I've really done here is taken the three parallel strands, pulled them around each other, like so, okay, and then just draw a line through the middle, and you see that everything below the line is the mirror image of everything above the line. Okay, that's cool. As this bit here suggests, we can represent the bosons by having trivially braided structures. So a W plus could be three parallel strands with three right-handed twists on them. A W minus could be three parallel strands with three left-handed twists on them. A Z naught could be three strands that aren't twisted. In principle, other braids which induce a trivial permutation are possible. So by that I mean that what marks the boson data as special is that the ordering 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 doesn't change at the top or bottom. You could have other braids that do the same thing which might also count as bosons. So something like this, 1 goes down to 1, 2 goes down to 2, 3 goes down to 3. That works as well. So these guys could also be bosons, for example, a gluon or a photon. And then the story that leaves us with is that we have a way of creating all the right fermions that are known from the standard model with all the right electric charges. Only left-handed neutrinos and right-handed antineutrinos, just like we get in the real world. All the right bosons, electromagnetic, weak, and colour interactions. I didn't discuss it properly, but you get proper conservation laws for electric charge and various other properties, and conservation of colour charge, and a full correspondence for a range of known quantum numbers. Once again, I don't really have time to go into that. So that gives us pretty much everything from electromagnetism, weak force, and the colour force. Now, if only we had gravity. Well, there's one thing we all learned from living through the 1980s, it's this. So the punchline is that all these twisty braided ribbon structures actually fit really automatically into the model from the idea of loop quantum gravity, that space-time is somehow built up from connections, you know, from these paths that connect from one place to another. So here we have a little diagram of one of these networks that I showed you before with nodes corresponding with volumes, connections between the nodes corresponding with areas, and hey presto, sitting in the middle of it all is a braid. So maybe if what I'm working on is on the right track, it turns out that particles, all the stuff that you and I are made of, all the stuff that we interact with day in and day out through our lives, are nothing but regions of space-time that are connected up in some weird, non-trivial way that would make your head hurt if you thought about it. You know, seriously, it would look like one of those cool Escher illustrations of a waterfall that always goes down and comes back to where it starts. It would be some very strange structure showing, hey, here's a region of space-time here, here's another region of space-time, they're sort of connected up in some weird, topologically deformed way. But it might turn out that the answer to the question, what's the difference between a region of empty space and a region of space with an electron sitting in it, is just that region of space is connected to all of its neighbours in some interesting, non-trivial way. So electromagnetism, the strong force, the weak force, all of the matter might just be extra properties of gravity at very small scales. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions?
We've already had it right here.
Yeah. Can you speak about the Higgs boson and if that actually fits in with this Michon model?
Okay.
What I've been told is this is sort of the mystery particle. If we get it, then that really provides a great unification between three fundamental forces. And I'm not sure how that all fits in.
Okay. So the Higgs is really the last missing piece of the standard model that hasn't been observed yet. I should preface my discussion here by saying that I believe the reason Higgs hasn't been found is because it doesn't exist. But the standard sort of explanation of where mass comes from is related to this thing called Higgs mechanism. And so the Higgs field, although the idea of the Higgs boson is that there's this field of particles, Higgs particles, that exist throughout the universe that everything interacts with and kind of creates like if there was no Higgs field, everything would just float through space freely with nothing to impede it. So it kind of creates a sort of drag or friction that slows things down and stops everything from moving at the speed of light. So we have a sort of field of these Higgs bosons. And you know, a particle will come through and clunk into a Higgs and then ricochet off here and then clunk in here and bounce off there and so on, rather than just going zip all the way through. And the end result is that this particle moves at less than the speed of light and therefore appears to have some sort of mass, which keeps it travelling subluminally. One of the nice things, one of the things that really persuades people that the Higgs is a plausible mechanism for the generation of mass is that you can calculate the mass of the W and Z particles very, very, very precisely if you believe that there is a Higgs. Okay. So the electromagnetic force is carried by photons. The weak force is carried, like I said, by W plus, W minus, and Z naught particles. Photon and Z naught have zero charge, but the big difference between them is that the Z naught actually has a fairly substantial mass. It's about, and so does the W plus and W minus, there's around about 90 mega electron volts worth of mass. So the reason why the W plus and W minus and Z naught have a mass is that they interact with the Higgs field. And it was calculated that they should have masses which were then measured to be precisely what they are, using the idea of a Higgs, and everyone said, wow, this is great, this proves that the Higgs mechanism is real, isn't this wonderful? So I can give you a relatively long drawn out explanation here. Because photons only travel at the speed of light, I mentioned that if you have a right-handed particle, right, zipping along that way, spinning that way, it's right-handed, you can turn it into a left-handed particle by reflecting it in a mirror. So now, still zipping along in the same direction, but that spin is going the other way. There's another way to turn a right-handed particle into a left-handed particle, and that is to change your reference frame. So imagine that you're chugging along here. This particle is moving along at some speed v, and you're moving along here observing it at a speed u, which is less than v. Now take another observer who's chugging along at a speed w, which is greater than v. They're looking back here, you're looking up here. So this observer, as far as this observer is concerned, because they're in a different reference frame, relative to them, they're moving faster than V. Relative to them, the particle's going back that way. Right? So what they're thinking is, here's a particle going back that way, spinning in that direction. Now it's spinning that way, but it's propagating that way, so it's a left-handed particle. Right, so boosting from one reference frame to another reference frame changes this particle from being right-handed to left-handed as well. Now, if this particle here is a photon, it's moving at a speed c. Right, you can never boost to go faster than the photon. So a photon will always be either left-handed or right-handed, depending on what you're looking at. Correspondingly, you could never boost into the reference frame where you're traveling at the same speed as the photon. So you remember I said that bosons have integer spin. Well, spin is quantized. Spin is quantized. So spin always changes by one unit, right? So if I have a particle that's got spin plus a half, plus one half, if I boost to another reference frame where it loses one unit of spin, then now it's got spin minus a half. But if I have, so that's for fermions. But for bosons, I might have a particle that has a spin plus one. I can boost it to another frame, it loses one unit, and now it's got spin zero. And then I boost again, and it's got spin minus one.
How come you can only boost once this time and you could have before?
No, this isn't a boost of a half. This is a boost of one as well, because the difference is plus half to minus a half. One.
Okay. How come you can't boost to a half then?
Because fermions and bosons don't produce, well, because spin is quantized. It's just one of the quirks of nature that that what defines something as being a fermion or a boson is how much it spins. And it all sort of comes out in the wash when you do the maths, but I'm not going to go through that here because we probably don't have much. So you would think that a particle that has integer spin, like a photon, should have three possible spin states, spin 1, spin 0, and spin minus 1. But because a photon is moving at the speed of light, you can never boost into a frame where you're traveling along at the same speed as the photon. So you can never see the spin 0 state. The photons are always either going to be exclusively left-handed or exclusively right-handed. Right? And that's just light. You know, this is just another way of saying that photons have circular polarization. Right? Circularly polarized one way or circularly polarized the other way. But W's and Z's do have mass, right? So they don't travel at the speed of light. So it is possible to boost into a frame where a W has either spin 1 or spin minus 1 or spin 0. Okay. And the Higgs, the way the Higgs mechanism gives the W's and Z's mass is that these guys start off being massless, just like the photon. And the Higgs field is actually a field of particles that all have spin 0. That's it. That's the only spin they can have. And when a W plus comes along and interacts with a Higgs, it kind of gobbles up the Higgs and acquires a spin 0 component. Right. So, but that's basically how physicists like to talk about it. They like to say that the weak bosons eat the Higgs field, and in doing so, they get massive. They put on weight. Right? So you have this field of things that are all spin 0 particles. Something comes along, interacts with them, goes from having just a spin 1 state or a spin minus 1 state to having a spin 0 state as well, and thereby become massive. Now, where does this all fit in? There's a very long-winded answer. Where does all of this fit in to the Richon model and what I've been talking about? Like I said, I'm a skeptic. I don't think Higgs is there. I think there's some other mass-generating mechanism that, I mean, I certainly hope that we don't discover the Higgs, because if we switch the Large Hadron Collider on later this year and discover the Higgs, and that's it, it'll be, well, that's boring. That's exactly what we were expecting. We don't learn anything new. Where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
But It's worth noting that, like I said, there's several ways of creating bosons. You can create a boson like this, or you can create a boson like this. So if somebody pushed me and said, where's the Higgs, I'd probably say, well, I think that the amount of braiding that you see in a braid structure corresponds with the amount of spin the particle has. And that this is a sort of, this is a spin one state, this is a spin zero state. So in a way, the Higgs is already living in the model. It's just already being gobbled up. So the Higgs doesn't exist there as some separate, as some sort of separate independent entity. It's just already being consumed.
Okay, I'm going to stop this there. Sundance, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. It's cool that the crowd afterwards, the person is at you.